Welcome to another edition of UBC Arts on Air, a show profiling remarkable UBC faculty, students, and occasionally administrators in the Faculty of Arts. I'm your host, Ira Nadell, and this evening, Professor Ian Hill of English, a specialist in rhetoric, technology, and even barcodes. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate being here.
It's a pleasure. Now, let's start with this notion of rhetoric and technology. How did the two come together? I would not have imagined such an association.
Well, I think there are two ways to think about rhetoric and technology. One way is just the ways that people argue and debate machines and systems. How do people advocate and dissent against our devices? And another way is to think about technology as being rhetorical in itself, that machines are persuasive.
So they have their own language in some fashion?
We could say that some machines do have their own language. Another way to think about it is that machines have a sort of a kind of agency, right? They sort of intervene into our daily affairs and in some ways goad us into certain behaviors and believing certain things.
And so this you connect with a certain rhetoric of the machine? Is that a likely statement?
We could say that. There's a term being bandied around by myself and some of my colleagues, machine rhetorics. And how many machine rhetorics there are that's up for debate.
Can you give me an example of a machine that would have a certain rhetoric associated with it? I mean, a smartphone instantly comes to mind, but you probably have some other example.
Sure. I think scientific visualization technologies are good examples. So, for instance, brain scans. The brain scan technology was designed to read the physiological processes that take place in our heads and then render that information into a visual form. But the results of the scan the scans are never programmed into the machine or the software. So it's really the machine that's producing the text independently of any sort of human will other than the desire to scan a brain.
Would a GPS device have its rhetoric in some fashion? Could we talk about it in those terms? I mean, and sometimes there's a voice that talks to me, and she or he, or a robotic generated voice.
Yes,
is speaking.
I like the way you're taking the conversation. Another way to think about machine rhetoric involves the texts that are produced by algorithms. And so a GPS satellite voice would be a good example. So if you programmed into a GPS to get from this radio station over to downtown, maybe this is something that the GPS doesn't know how to communicate per se. It's just the algorithm is able to use the geographic data and generate a text. Wikipedia also is a good example of an algorithm that can generate encyclopedia entries. Right? So some Wikipedia entries are generated by users. Others are generated by what are called Wikibots. Facebook does the same thing. Facebook uses algorithms to create profile pages for figures or things that are not popular enough to actually have a human take the time to generate a Facebook page.
Okay, so tell me, how did you become interested in this? Did you wake up one morning and suddenly think about connections between rhetoric and machines in some way? Or are you actually a closet musician who's always fooled around with electronics and said, there's something connected here? How did it start?
I'm actually the son of a musician who likes to fool around with electronic music. So perhaps that is a sort of a unconscious motivation. My interest in rhetoric and technology really stems from my first semester of coursework as a PhD student studying rhetoric at the University of Illinois. I was simultaneously taking a seminar about the philosophy of technology and a seminar about the rhetorician Kenneth Burke, and the overlaps were substantial. And as I did some initial research, I found that the scholarship on rhetoric of technology or rhetoric and technology needed more, more input, more theory, and more analysis. So that's, I saw an opening, and I was enthused about the possibilities of studying gadgets.
But rhetoricians traditionally do not link, at least it's my understanding, rhetoric and technology. We are back to argument, persuasion, logic, speech.
Yes.
Do you find resistance from rhetoricians when you connect these two?
there is an old guard that does not like any of the recent turns in rhetoric toward, for instance, visual rhetorics, or the rhetoric of images, sonic rhetoric, the rhetoric of sound, material rhetoric. So maybe not just technologies, but the ways that public memorials or monuments, rather, sort of direct and get us to act in certain ways. The old guard would like to limit the study of rhetoric to, mostly public oratory, and if not that, then texts, traditional texts, written texts.
Is there a danger in that suddenly everything becomes rhetorical?
In the field of rhetoric, this is called big rhetoric. So you're anticipating or the history of rhetoric, right? Very well. I would say the 1990s, starting in the 1980s, but really in the 1990s, when there became a rhetoric of everything, a rhetoric of economics, rhetoric of science, rhetoric of technology, various material, visual, and sonic rhetorics, it became obvious that anything could potentially be rhetorical if we open the field up as widely as rhetoricians have. So I welcome that. I welcome that move. And the controversy is mostly finished, I think.
In other words, it's pretty much acknowledged that it does exist and that it's not so much your invention of the idea of big rhetoric, it's simply the identification that it's there.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So. And the more we examine even the ancient Greco-Roman texts on rhetoric by Aristotle, Cicero, Isocrates, etc., they often there are phrases or passages that hint that even the Greco-Romans were open to the concept of big rhetoric, but their interests were very much directed on public speaking.
Indeed, public speaking, of course. Now, I believe you also have an interest and have been studying barcodes.
I have.
How does that connect up with your current research interests?
I'm interested in barcodes as an example of a machine-generated and machine-read language. Some barcodes Well, if we think about the UPC, the Universal Pricing Code barcode, have very rigid parameters such that a machine can generate barcodes without really any input from managers. But then there are much more freeform types of barcodes, like the QR code, which is the black splotchy box that is appearing on everything now. And those can say pretty much anything we want them to without... Well, there are word limits on a QR code. The QR code can't contain too much information that the pixels are rendered too small to be easily picked up by a QR code reader or scanner.
So, but a barcode has or constructs its own language and it extended to its own rhetoric? Is that fair to say? Give me the history of barcodes. And why should I even care about barcodes other than they're on everything?
Well, the barcodes were invented by product managers to keep track of goods being shipped and being sold. So basically to keep track of merchandise. And they were fairly limited in their usages for a few decades. This is early 1970s that barcodes are developed. But once they're developed, the number of barcode types proliferates very quickly. So within a couple decades, there are probably hundreds of barcode systems, but they're all very similar. They're just being used to manage merchandise. I first became interested in barcodes when I heard about a group called Recode. And this is a group that understood that barcodes are easily hacked. They're so easy to produce. Right, the easy functionality for managers is that it's easy to make and print and scan barcodes. So therefore, it's very equally as easy for hackers to make print and print barcodes. So the idea behind Recode is that a form of consumer activism would be to produce our own barcodes, go into stores, put the stickers on the wrong products, and then go check out. And Recode was, they were more of a prankster group, right? But there are other purveyors of the same idea who are advocating outright thievery, right? Go put on a soda can barcode onto a TV box and do a self-checkout and steal.
I understand.
Right. That's how I got interested in barcodes, was that sort of the idea of hacking barcodes and using barcodes with using the same functions of the barcode to sort of subvert the managerial system. But then QR codes open up sort of the realm of what barcodes are capable of to a much, they extend the capabilities.
Is there a dictionary of barcodes? Are barcodes limited or are they infinite in terms of how we would construct a barcode? And how do you make a barcode?
Well, a UPC barcode is very limited. There's really about sort of 8 items of data that can be transmitted with a UPC barcode. And so this is always... usually the manufacturer gets half of the barcode and the retailer gets the other half of the barcode so that they can manage what product is being sold. So they know what product is being scanned and how much it costs,
In my retail outlet, I have a shoe store, for example. Do I have someone who's in charge of barcodes and I coordinate my barcode with you as the manufacturer of the shoes and you may be, who knows, anywhere in the world, in Spain? How does it work?
But almost always barcodes are determined by the manufacturer. And then the retailer enters the barcode into their point of sale system, and then that allows the retailer to set the price and know when things are being sold.
So basically,
the retailer only inputs the price at the end.
Okay.
It usually does not create their own barcodes, but they can.
We can talk then about a rhetoric of barcodes?
Sure.
Which would be what? I mean, what characteristics determine the rhetoric of barcodes?
Well, this is something I'm working out.
Well, give us a hint. Here's your chance.
Well, my project on barcodes starts with what I would call the rhetoric of barcodes, and this is simply how do managers, producers, and hackers debate the various merits of the barcode system. And that's part of the program, but then the question is, what are the barcodes themselves doing? What is their function beyond just helping managers? And so it does seem that the design of the barcode sort of is goading the hackers and the pranksters to convincing them in a way that there is an easy way to subvert this managerial process and perform a type of commercial activism or anti-commercial activism.
So is the QR code more secure than a barcode?
No. I would think they're equally reproducible. It's very easy. It's even easier to produce a QR code than it is to produce a barcode, even though the QR code has many more points of data. You can go online, and there are multiple QR code generator websites where you just go to the website and you paste in or type in the text or information that you want the QR code to transmit, and hit click, and it generates a QR code that you can then copy and put on a poster or put on a sticker or send in an email or however you want to use it.
So do you bring in this discussion of barcodes and QR codes into your teaching, into the courses that you've done on rhetoric, materiality, technology?
I have not brought in barcodes. That's because I guess my project is unfinished and there's not a comparable project I've found that talks about rhetoric and barcodes. When I have been teaching rhetoric, technology, and materiality, I'm looking more at usually machines, but also some of the wiki bots and algorithmic authors that we were discussing earlier.
Okay, well, I believe another area that interests you has this wonderful rubric entitled, and it's perfect for a radio show and a radio station, Sonic Torture.
Right.
What's that?
Well, Sonic Torture...
Hip-hop, maybe? Rap?
Any kind of sound can be tortuous. It just depends on the loudness and the constancy, right? So if someone were listening to this conversation for 30 hours on end at top volume and probably in the dark or with strobe lights, sit in, perhaps in a very uncomfortable position, I'm pretty sure that we would be accomplices to torture. Sonic torture is the practice of, as interrogators say, breaking prisoners with the use of sound. So this means sort of psychologically breaking down someone to the point where they're willing to either admit guilt or divulge information after being subjected to sound at very high volumes for a long time.
This is interesting. So it becomes a method of interrogation, of torture?
Well, it depends who you ask, whether it would be interrogation or torture. I would say that it is definitely a form of torture. But during the Abu Ghraib scandal in the United States and the war on terror, we've all heard about the enhanced interrogation techniques that were used by the U.S. military. And sonic torture was among those that was justified, right, by the rather I don't know what's the right word, the long string of documents that led from the White House to Abu Ghraib.
Is sonic torture something that's been around for some time and we've only identified it and labeled it this way, or is it certainly or strictly a late 20th century, early 21st century act?
I think it's a... I don't want to say that no one was ever tortured by sound previous to the 20th century, because there are some historical ties backwards. But the ability to... sound reproduction technology is basically necessary to create the conditions for this sort of constant high-volume noise that's necessary for sonic torture.
Well, I'm thinking of some older films where, you know, Napoleon's army is moving forward and there's this constant sound of cannons being fired. Or even in the Civil War, American Civil War, a constant noise from cannons. And even though the population is not in the direct line of fire, the fear and anxiety created by the noise of the cannons firing creates a kind of powerful anxiety and, I suppose, torture, in the sense they know the war is around them, but they are not immediately harmed by it, but they are harmed by it in certain ways.
Yes, and the sound of war, especially, has a historical record, right, of creating exactly the type of psychological anxiety that you're talking about. There's the biblical story that I'm not an expert on, but the walls of Jericho were brought down, right, by the trumpets, right? And so this is a metaphor for, the sound didn't break the walls of Jericho, right, but it probably did break the spirits, right, of the residents, and it caused the collapse of the city.
Well, I'm going to have to go back to Homer now and look at the Odyssey and the Iliad, you see, and I'm sure there are instances there, and particularly with Odysseus hearing the Song of the Sirens,
right,
which is a kind of alluring torture. I mean, it's a torture of a sense.
Right. The sailors are unable to resist, right, the call.
So advertisements might be thought of as a form of sonic torture.
Well, I would agree flippantly that yes, advertisements are a form of sonic torture. But sonic torture and advertising noise are both designed, right, to get people to act in different but specific ways, right? So Muzak, for instance, is designed to enhance our shopping experience so that we're more willing to purchase products. So a different result, but the idea that sound is being manipulated or designed, right, to make us do specific acts is common to both.
Did you grow up listening to the radio very much?
I did. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and my hometown is Lewisburg, and there was nearby in Selins Grove, Susquehanna University. When I was a child and had a fantastic college radio station. All of the great specialty shows that you would expect from a good college radio station.
As we have here on CITR.
Exactly.
That's very, very exciting. Now, we're sort of winding up, but I wanted to ask you what you think the future of rhetorical studies might be. 5-10 years from now, what will it look like, or what will you and students be examining?
I think the field of rhetoric changes or has changed at a fairly slow pace. So the movement we talked about earlier to big rhetoric, this was a huge move, opening up this rhetoric to the study of everything, basically. And so the question now is what fields will we choose to sort of bring into our analyses? And I think there will be a movement toward more object-oriented approaches. So, you know, for instance, looking at technology, looking at the world of things, looking at language as an artifact, an object, more so than a text, perhaps. So I see a movement in that direction, but then there's also such a large amount of more traditional textual artifacts that have been totally unexplored by rhetoricians that those will always be open for further exploration.
So can we blame the digital revolution for somehow, and I don't mean blame in a negative way, but as a cause for opening up rhetoric and rhetorical study? Or
that's,
it's at least contributed to it.
That's a good question. I believe we have a lot more different kinds of texts now to look at and to grapple with. On the composition side of rhetoric, you know, sort of teaching first-year writing courses and such things, there is a movement to you figure out how best to teach writing for the internet, right? Write academic work in a blog post rather than maybe a traditional research essay. In my own class, we're just learning how we all learned how to write memes, right? The sort of silly pictures with captions that are taking over the internet, and we had a meme war in class, and it was a highly gratifying day of class, I will say.
I think I should actually attend that class, because I myself find the challenge of writing captions to photographs quite challenging, because you must condense so much information into essentially two sentences. Have you ever tried it?
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. During the meme war, we all. Well, I don't know about every student weighed in, but I weighed in, and most of my students weighed in, and it is difficult to, first of all, capture the moment, and relate the message to a picture that often has nothing to do with the message or is only tangentially related to the message. So, in some ways, it's constraining, but in other ways, it opens us up to an infinite number of combinations.
Absolutely. Well, this is really fascinating. Ian, thank you so much for coming in. It's my great pleasure to thank again Professor Ian Hill, who has joined us this evening at UBC Arts on Air. And I hope listeners will stay tuned for future programs